Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome to The Interpreter Show. Tonight I am Neil Rapley, joined here in studio by my lovely and amazing wife, Jasmine Rapley. It is just the two of us today, no Hales joining us from on the phone, and nobody else here in the studio. So hopefully we can sufficiently fill the time. We'd just like to remind everyone that the Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by LDSAgents.com, a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality real estate agents serving Latter-day Saints nationwide and in Canada for more than 20 years. Whether you're buying or selling a home, be in touch with LDSAgents.com. Their professional, friendly real estate agents will help you find just the home you're looking for that meets your needs in a safe neighborhood with the right schools and a temple not far away. Now, it's easy to find a real estate agent who speaks your language and shares your values. Whether you're buying or selling, no matter where you are, let LDSAgents.com reduce the stress of your move. That's LDSAgents.com. All right, so
today we've got a few items of church news in the last week or so. One point of interest is that this last week, the church celebrated the 175th anniversary of the Mormon Battalion's arrival. For those who are unfamiliar, there's a visitor center to commemorate the Mormon Battalion in Southern California. And so Elder Christofferson went out this week to visit the old town San Diego State Historic Park and to honor some of these important pioneers in church history. Right now, the director of the Mormon Battalion Visitor Center is BYU professor Brent Topp, I believe, who have recently replaced Brad Dansell Allen, who interestingly are my aunt and uncle.
Just so happened to be related to
and they
us.
Had an incredible experience serving as the directors of that site, and there's just miracles and hard work, and it's a beautiful experience. I've never been to the Mormon Battalion Visitor Center myself. Have you ever been?
Yeah, I actually had a chance to go, it must have been around 2018, I would guess. It was before Brad and Dansell were out there, I can tell you that much. It's a really great, it's actually a cool little place, some great history. They have, a fun kind of interactive sort of, tour experience, I guess, where they kind of take you through the history of the Mormon Battalion in a, kind of interactive way. And then they have some stuff there at the end where you can look up people who were in the Mormon Battalion, see if there's any of your ancestors are in there. You can kind of pan for gold and stuff like that. There's a lot of fun stuff they have there. It's a really cool site.
That's awesome. So it's celebrated its 175th year since the arrival of the Mormon Battalion, and they had a lovely celebration in the community and with the Latter-day Saint Visitor Center there. In other news, the First Presidency decided to extend the open house for the Washington, D.C. Temple. This one's pretty fun because initially the Washington, D.C. Temple open house was scheduled to be kind of a standard 6 weeks, I believe, but there was so much demand that they extended it through August. And so The temple will be open for visitors sometime this spring. I don't have the exact dates here, but then it'll be dedicated on August 14th now instead of its earlier date in June. And this is a really remarkable temple. I mean, it was built in the 1974 was when it was first built. So, and its architecture is certainly reminiscent of the 1970s aesthetic, but it's absolutely majestic, and the way that it just pops out of the horizon over the interstate has been the cause of I'm sure multiple accidents over the years. It's very distracting as you're on the highway and you don't expect it. It's not like Utah where you can see the whole valley. And as you're looking over the whole valley on the I-15, you can see five temples in your own view. Out east, I mean, you've got the hills and the forests and the winding roads. And then all of a sudden, popping out of the Maryland horizon is this incredibly massive, brilliantly white, castle-like structure. It's affectionately called like Dorothy's House of the Emerald City because, I mean, it looks kind of like the 1930s film of the Emerald City just in white. And so it's gorgeous and it's quite the monument and landmark even for non-Latter-day Saints out there because it's just a pinnacle. I grew up with that temple before the Boston Temple was dedicated in the year 2000. That was the temple that was assigned to my district. And so I have fond memories of, as a family, going down there and spending the weekend in Washington, D.C., mostly just to visit the temple, but every once in a while to do some sightseeing and to spend good time as a family together. So I have a lot of fond memories in that temple. It's a beautiful structure inside and out, and I'm looking forward to seeing what it looks like. I mean, I haven't taken a ton of time to look at the photographs of the interior. I do believe they've updated it quite a bit aesthetically to be more of a modern aesthetic. And I always have mixed feelings when they do this with temples because on the one hand, you want to make sure that the architecture is not distracting. And if it's standing out to you as a very garish 1970s aesthetic, maybe that's distracting for worshipers. On the other hand, as someone who loves history, it makes me sad whenever we change something that has historic value to it, even if it was just the 1970s, which was not that long ago. There's something to be said for its own beauty. I mean, it recently happened with the South Jordan or the Jordan River Temple when they renovated it, kind of updating from that 1960s aesthetic into a more modern one. And it's beautiful and it's got lovely, like, dark wood paneling. But on the same time,
it doesn't have escalators anymore. Where are the escalators? That was where I got my endowment taken out the first time. And I thought all temples must have escalators because that's the only thing I'd ever known. But yeah.
And that was the temple you grew up with. And so while the new temple design is absolutely beautiful, it's also, you know, it's missing what you grew up with a little bit. So, I look forward to seeing what the Washington, D.C. temple looks like. And, I hope that the church has a really good experience with this open house because not only is it significant, for the community, like normal temples are, but because of its location in Washington, D.C., it has particular import. I mean, most temple open houses are opportunities for Latter-day Saints to outreach to the community and say, hey, you ever wanted to see inside a Mormon temple? Now's your chance. And to have dignitaries and local politicians and authorities and people from other religions to come and see the temple. And so for this in Washington, D.C., being at quite the, it's kind of the center of the United States political world, and it's very conveniently located outside of the D.C. Capitol. So I anticipate that the church is already doing a lot to plan and prepare for those VIP tours. And hopefully it's a great opportunity for the church and others outside of our faith to appreciate what the temple has to offer and why it's so special to us. And I do imagine there's a little bit of a curiosity factor from a lot of people not of the faith who have just driven by that giant castle every day since 1974 and never got a chance to see what's inside.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's true. In other news, some of you may remember last year the Witnesses Project that Interpreter Foundation has been heavily involved in, and the film that came out in, I think it was it June that it came out last year, June 2021, The Witnesses. That project is still ongoing. People may not be aware that that film was not the end, but it was really almost a beginning in a lot of ways. There's still more coming out from that project, and Dan Peterson, head of the Interpreter Foundation, I'm not sure what his official title is, I should probably know that.
Founder, chairman?
Founder, chairman of the Interpreter Foundation. He recently announced the forthcoming film, Undaunted, Witnesses of the Book of Mormon, which will be premiering. I think there's two premiere events. One is scheduled for later this month, and then it'll be officially premiering on March 4th, Friday, March 4th, 2022, as part of the LDS Film Festival. And tickets are currently available, I believe.
And it'll be at the Sarah Center Theater in Oregon.
Right, yeah. And this film, you may be wondering, how is this going to be different from the Witnesses film that came out last year? So this film is actually going to be more of a documentary style film. It's going to have... The Witnesses film last year really only covered Martin Harris, David Whitmer, and Oliver Cowdery. And, of course, Joseph Smith is part of that. And it was primarily a narrative and just telling their story. And as Dan Peterson's mentioned many times, it was hard to try and tell the story of all four of those protagonists all at once. But in Undaunted, they're going to bring in the testimony of the eight witnesses, along with other informal or unofficial witnesses, such as Mary Whitmer, Josiah Stoll, several others could probably be named. And it's going to be a docudrama. So there will be some, they will have footage with the same actors that showed up in Witnesses. There will be footage reenacting various occasions and events and stuff as the stories are told. But then there will also be snippets from different scholars talking about the witnesses and their testimony and things like that. And so this is actually the part of the project I'm probably most excited about. I love the Witnesses film, don't get me wrong. But I'm really excited to see how this came together. And we've had a chance to see
We saw a little sneak peek.
About 20 minutes long several months ago, and it looked very exciting. So it's been coming along really well, and we're excited to see how this has come together.
And for those who may not be terribly excited by a documentary, it's also, I think, noteworthy to point out that this isn't just scholars talking with reused footage from the film.
Yeah.
They filmed, like, fresh footage specifically for the documentary. So there's tons of footage that you haven't seen before, reenacting new scenes with different witnesses or with the same witnesses but doing different kind of things depending on whatever they're talking about in the documentary. So it really is a kind of a docudrama. I mean, it's dramatized in a brilliantly new way with scholars commenting on it and providing additional information. So I think it'll be a very entertaining viewing, as well as hopefully something very informative and educational and inspiring. Because at the end of the day, you know, the purpose of all of this is to build our testimonies of the restoration of the gospel, of Joseph Smith, of the witnesses. And I think the tone they use does that pretty well. They're able to really bear testimony through the acting, through the scholars, through the narrative that they tell in the documentary itself. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing the full thing on March 4th. It'll be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Also in other news, the church recently announced the release of Joseph Smith Papers' Revelations and Translation Series, Volume 5, which is the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon.
Which dovetails pretty well with the Witnesses.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it does. this is really exciting. I don't know if that's the... I think that is the completion of the Revelations and Translation series. I can't remember. I should probably pull something
sure.
up.
I'm not sure. But it should be if it's not. I mean, it's a massive book. And I know this has been the most highly anticipated Book of the Joseph Smith Papers volume. The Book of Mormon original manuscript has never been photographically published like this before. It's incredible and immaculate.
Yeah, so just for some background, the original manuscript does not survive in full. There's only about 28% of the original manuscript extant today. That's still a lot of text. I mean, the Book of Mormon is a big book, so the church did a really high quality edition with photographic, you know, high quality photos of the different pages. Made sure, you know, I don't even know all the technical details about the style of photography and stuff like that they used to make sure they were able to bring out the text on the page really clearly and make it just kind of legible and pop out there. And then, of course, they also have a transcript side by side, just like they do in all their other facsimile edition. Their facsimile editions in the Joseph Smith Papers Project, so that you can read the transcript side by side with the document if you find the handwriting difficult to read or whatever. But if you don't trust the transcript, you've got the document right there, and you can try to read that as well. And one of the nice things they did, I'm trying to see if they have a picture of it here, because it's so fragmentary, oftentimes what survives of a page will just be, you know, partial lines of the text. And because they can pick up where that is in the Book of Mormon, they're able to show you what's missing on each side. They, of course, bracket that in the transcript so that you know that's not actually extant in the manuscript itself. But to help give you context as you're trying to read and see, okay, how does the wording or any difference here actually fit within the broader context of this passage? That can be hard to do when you've only got the fragmentary text in front of you. So I really appreciate that they fill in the missing text around those fragments. Again, using editorial practices to make it clear they're filling that in. But
and I believe they also used some multispectral imaging technology because
right.
A lot of these manuscripts, not only we only have little tiny fragments of them, but the ink itself is almost impossible to read with the naked eye. And even these expert historians who have been specifically trained in this can't replicate what the writing is on the paper nearly as well as some of these high-powered camera scanners can. They can absorb all the data that's on the paper and be able to interpret those very faint pencil markings more clearly, or the ink markings more clearly, so that we can finally read them, transcribe them, and preserve them for future generations. So what you see in the Joseph Smith Papers volume, those are, in many cases, enhanced images. They don't look nearly so clear and neat in real life, but rather they've enhanced them so that they can be legible, and you can compare, like Neil said, the transcript with the image itself, and it's just an invaluable resource. The bad news is it's a kind of expensive for your average user. I mean, it's $89 right now.
Yeah, it's
but
a pricey
it's not
volume.
Overpriced because this thing is huge. It's like a 30-pound book.
I was really surprised at how thick it was. It's probably about 3 inches thick.
Yeah, and it's 3 inches thick, and it's like folio size wide. So it's a very large book, very heavy, and high-quality binding, high-quality paper, thick paper. So it's not overpriced. It's a high-quality book, but the good news is that the church announced in about 18 months they will have finally put all of this material online on the Joseph Smith Papers website. And that'll be invaluable for researchers too, because now not only can you see it for free online and you can zoom in, but you can search their database and find things
yeah.
that you're looking for.
And when they put this stuff online, I mean, the Joseph Smith Papers, the images are so high resolution and so clear, and you can just zoom right in on things and really analyze it closely if you need to. It's an amazing, amazing resource. And of course, we shouldn't undersell the extensive and detailed historical introduction.
Yeah.
That just provides a lot of the valuable background information to this manuscript, to the translation of the Book of Mormon, all of that. You know, this is, when we say the original manuscript, we're talking about the manuscript that was pen to paper, Joseph's scribe, as Joseph is dictating the words of the Book of Mormon. And so this is like as close to the revelatory event, the moment the text was revealed, as you can possibly get.
Yeah, this is as close to the gold plates as you're going to get.
And yeah, I mean, this is, you can imagine when Oliver Cowdery talks about those being days never to be forgotten, to sit under the voice dictated by heaven. I'm probably butchering the quote right now. This is what he's talking about. You're looking at that when you look at these high resolution multispectral images and stuff like that. You are looking at what he's talking about when he talks about days never to be forgotten, sitting there as the scribe, as Joseph dictates, and it can really there's something powerful about seeing that it's more or less. There are certainly differences. There's been edits and changes over the years and mistakes, but it's more or less the same text that you're familiar with, but there's just something powerful about seeing it in that original, knowing you're looking at the very words Oliver Cowdery penned, right, as Joseph Smith dictated, or, you know, whoever else may have been the scribe at on a particular page. But
yeah, I've been... So I took a look at the JSP volume of the original manuscript, and it is very impressive. And I was also using, in my work this week, the JSP volume that published the Joseph Smith papyri. And that one was also very helpful. I mean, it has its weaknesses like any work, but I appreciated the meticulous work that the historians put into the introduction. All these historical introductions and source information, these headnotes to kind of help you give context of where these documents are coming from, how they're organized, because especially with the Book of Abraham, these issues can get very, very complicated, and there's a lot we don't know about the translation process, the manuscript process, and if you're someone who's just coming into the study of the Book of Abraham, you hear a lot of words tossed around like Joseph Smith Papyri, Kirtland Egyptian Papers, grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language. And it's hard to kind of make sense of what all these documents are, where one can find them. But I did think the Joseph Smith Papers volume of this one made it pretty easy to figure out and to see what we have. When we say Joseph Smith Papyri, what are we talking about? Oh, we have three fragments of the Book of the Dead, or the Book of Breathings. We've got two fragments of the Book of Breathings, three fragments of the Book of the Dead, another set of fragments of the Book, and it just lays out, you know, itemized for you. Here's what we have. This is what the church has. Here are all the manuscripts laid out, and here's kind of the context of when these were written, who may have been involved in the scribal process. And they try their best to give an impassive view of how these documents are interacting with each other. But the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon is particularly helpful because having that as a researcher now gives people the opportunity to compare variants. I mean, Neil, do you have any examples you can think of or ways that being able to compare the printer's manuscript with the original manuscript might be helpful for people who want to understand the Book of Mormon better?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I have anything right off the top of my head. Certainly, just as a general rule, as a general principle, right, the earliest you can get, the closest you can get to the original text, the better. And, in biblical textual criticism, right, that's textual criticism being the discipline by which scholars analyze all the manuscripts we have and try to determine what is the original reading. And that takes a lot of guesswork because, for the most part, the earliest manuscripts we have when it comes to the New Testament are from, like, the 4th century A.D. The earliest manuscripts we have for the Old Testament are... in the Dead Sea Scrolls and come from the, I think the earliest is maybe the 2nd or 3rd century B.C., but that's still several hundred years after the last books were written. And and when we talk about the earliest manuscript, so there are a couple of fragments earlier with the New Testament. I know there's one that might be 2nd century. Don't quote me on any of this. I'm not super up to date on what the earliest manuscripts in New Testament are. But there's when we talk about the earliest manuscript, though, we're not talking about a complete version of a particular text. We are talking about any fragment of it at all. And so sometimes, like, yeah, our earliest manuscript might be from the 2nd century AD, for instance, with some New Testament book or passage, but it only has like 10 words on it. And those 10 words are not sequential words because mm-hmm. it's like a stamp size fragment from the middle of a page, and so you've got like 10 lines on top of each other with one word each, and you're like, oh, we're pretty sure that's John 1 something or whatever, right? Like, it's really hard to work with that kind of evidence, and it's harder still to try and figure out what the earliest reading is because you're several hundred years removed from your earliest writings. So in biblical studies, they would absolutely kill to even have 28% of the original manuscript, of their earliest manuscript of the first handwritten manuscript of these texts. And that's what we have with the first, original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. And then, frankly, they would probably kill to have 100% of the second copy. And that's what we've got with the printer's manuscript. We're missing three lines of the printer's manuscript, but other than that, I guess we maybe only have 99.9% of the text. But we can get very, very close to what the original text is with these manuscripts, and that makes a big difference. And I don't know that I can think of a specific passage off the top of my head.
Well, I can think of one that's not the Book of Mormon. I recently, in the last few weeks, have been looking more into Book of Moses evidences and things like that, and one of the interesting pieces of evidence we have for the Book of Moses is the attestation of Mahuja in antiquity.
Oh, yes.
There's a character called Mahuja who shows up in the Book of Moses in chapter 6 and in chapter 7. It shows up possibly as a place name, and this character is sent to inquire of Enoch, and in the Book of Moses the character just asks him about his interpretations, where he comes from, etc. Well, we have an attestation of this character in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Book of the Giants, where he is sent to inquire of Enoch of the interpretation of his dreams. And so it is quite remarkable that we've got a similar character doing similar things with a similar name. It's not like word for word. You have to do a little bit of reconstructing, but it's a reasonable approximation of the name Mahuja. Slash Mahijah, and there's a little bit of discrepancy there because the manuscripts of the Book of Moses aren't super clear. The Book of Moses was done in two manuscripts. You had, I believe, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I believe Emma was a scribe for a first portion of the first manuscript of the Book of Moses, and that's what we often call Manuscript Old Testament 1. And then after Joseph Smith got to a certain point, he then made the second Old Testament manuscript where they copied what they had done up to that point and then continued onward. And so we've got two manuscripts of this passage, and both of them have, and both of them are a little confusing as to if there's a U there or an I there. And that makes the difference between Mahuja or Mahija, which makes a difference of if we have a real attestation of it in the ancient world or not. And especially because there's a discrepancy between Moses chapter 6 and Moses chapter 7. In Moses chapter 6, there's a person named Mahijah in our current text. In Moses chapter 7, there's another name is Mahuja, but it seems to be a place name. Well, if you look in the first manuscript, it seems that originally It almost seems that the Mahijah that's mentioned was meant to be a character, and it is unclear if that's meant to be an I or a U, even in both manuscripts. And so I'm going on and on all day about this, but the point being that you can use these manuscripts to help reconstruct the past a little bit by comparing Old Testament Manuscript 1 with Old Testament Manuscript 2 of Moses chapter 6. You can discern if it really should be spelled Mahuja or if it should be spelled Mahijah. And similarly, when you go to chapter 7, is it Mahuja or is it Mahijah? And is it a person or is it a place? And that's illumination you really can only get by going to the original manuscripts. And it's pretty fun to be going back with this to these 19th century documents, looking at the handwriting, trying to make an argument for what they're actually being written down as, and it can get a little technical and tedious, and some of the textual variants are, I mean, there's nothing more tedious than dealing with textual manuscripts in a lot of ways, but that's why we have brilliant scholars who have done a lot of this work, such as Royal Skousen. He's been a pioneer in this field of documenting all textual variants we can find between the manuscripts that we currently have of the Book of Mormon and helping to make a little bit of sense of them, what they mean, why some of them were made, and what they can tell us about the text, and whether the text we have now is authoritative, or maybe there's a reading in an original manuscript that we could look at that might have an improved reading. It's hard to say. But Royal Skousen has done some pretty great work on that.
So I guess for an example that actually does come from the Book of Mormon, in 3rd Nephi, or not 3rd Nephi, in 1st Nephi 13, verse 24, there is, where did my, there we go. So in 1st Nephi 13:24, in the 1830 edition, when it was published, it said that it's talking about the book that proceeded forth from the mouth of a Jew. And when it proceeded forth from the mouth of a Jew, it contained the plainness of the gospel of the Lord. Well, if you look that up in your Book of Mormon today, you'll see it says the fullness of the gospel of the Lord. And that is actually a correction to the text that was made because of the careful scrutiny of the original manuscript by scholars, I assume by Royal Skousen, but I don't know, in this case. But, I mean, Royal Skousen has documented the change, but this change was made to the 1981 edition, so I'm not sure how soon, who necessarily picked up on that before 1981. But that is an example of a difference, and maybe you don't think that makes a big difference in meaning, the fullness of the gospel versus the plainness of the gospel. Nephi talks a lot about plainness anyhow. But the fullness of the gospel is what's restored, and that's what the Bible had when it first proceeded forth, and then it came to be missing. And that makes a difference in what the text is saying here. So that's just one small example where knowing what the original earliest manuscript said in a particular place has actually allowed us to update and correct the current text of the Book of Mormon.
That's a really great example. So, anyway, we recommend all of you to either purchase the massive new volume of the Joseph Smith Papers or wait till it comes out online so you can search for yourself and just flip through those pages and feel like you're so close to the prophet and to the Book of Mormon and to those earliest revelations from God. It's just inspiring. I mean, I get chills looking at the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. I mean, not the original, but as I flipped through the Joseph Smith facsimiles, it was just like, wow, this really is as close as it gets. It's remarkable.
Absolutely.
Well, in other news, not this past week, but the week before, BYU announced that, the church, I should say, announced that all CES employees in the church educational system will now be required to have and hold a temple recommend. This is quite an interesting development for a variety of reasons. It certainly doesn't happen in a vacuum. So the whole parameter of this is that new employees who are employed by the church educational system will be required to hold and be worthy of a temple recommend. This includes all faculty at BYU. This includes all seminary and institute teachers. This includes some part-time, it includes all part-time employees at any of those institutions, but students at BYU are exempt unless they work at the MTC, there was one other place, or if they're an FSY counselor, that was it, because those are very gospel-oriented teaching positions. And current employees are also going to be encouraged to opt into this new policy. They received an email on January 30th inviting them to agree to these terms that they would hold and be worthy of a temple recommend from here on out. They didn't clarify that there aren't going to be consequences for employees who choose not to opt into this. but they highly encourage employees to do so. So that's the basic gist of what this new policy is. It definitely is going to have interesting implications, and as far as the reasons behind it, it's unclear. I mean, the church didn't say exactly why they were doing it, but up to this point, the requirements for CES faculty have been to have an ecclesiastical endorsement and to agree to live by the honor code, if you're at BYU, for example. And that requires, the honor code is a standard of conduct that's very much about behavior. It's have adhere to specific dress and grooming standards, don't use profane language, don't drink coffee or alcohol, or obey the law of chastity, things like that. And an ecclesiastical endorsement is when you have to get approval from your bishop every single year that you are still essentially in good standing in the church. And that requires an interview with your bishop to just touch base, if you're a student at least, and the bishop will approve or deny your ecclesiastical endorsement for the year. So there is, that's how the church currently assesses whether its employees behave by church standards and are in good standing with the church. This new addition of requiring employees to be worthy of a temple recommend does increase, heighten the bar a little bit, because the temple recommend isn't just a code of behavior, it also is a code of belief. It requires you to affirm certain statements of belief, such as, do you believe in the Godhead, God the Eternal Father, His Son Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost? Do you sustain the prophet and all general authorities? Do you believe and affirm the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, such as the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith, etc., etc.? And do you behave in accordance with Christian values when it comes to your family life? Do you have obligations to a former spouse or children that you are current in? Things like that. And so while the ecclesiastical endorsement and the honor code enforces behavior, the temple recommend adds a belief element. Do you also believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ, not just be willing to obey by its standards?
I suppose to clarify, I don't remember if this was mentioned, but like there are non-Latter-day Saint professors and stuff that work at BYU, and they will obviously not be expected to hold and be worthy of a temple recommend. They will, of course, still be expected to abide by, agree to the honor code and abide by that code of conduct and behavior. The difference that this makes as far as, you know, the standards that you're expected to live by haven't really changed. This is just basically, it does add an element of belief to, you were supposed to be living the kind of life that would make you worthy of a temple recommend in the first place. They're now just saying, well, you should also have it. And like Jasmine mentioned, that does add a dimension of affirming certain beliefs, as the temple recommend questions indicate. From what I understand, what is unclear is how this is going to be implemented as far as professors who do or don't opt in, who have, you know, people who already work there. And we spoke to one professor that, you know, we won't name because we didn't. But, you know, he was kind of explaining he just doesn't know what are the pros and cons of either opting in or not opting in, and administration hasn't really clearly explained that to them yet. And so,
right. The statement has made clear that there won't be, you're not going to be forced to opt into this, and there won't be consequences if you don't. Like, you're not going to get fired if you don't. So then the question is, well, what is the incentive to do so? And yeah, that's
right.
Unclear.
And in most, you know, in most workplaces, when you work somewhere and there's a new policy change, and you can either, you know, they you know, different companies will do things differently, but, you know, they give you, they make a policy change and they give you an option as someone who's already there to either maintain the original policy or be grandfathered into, no, that's actually the reverse, but, you know, to opt into the new policy, you know, they're usually they'll usually have like a human resources department, right, who will explain to you, if you opt in, this is what happens, these are the benefits you get, but these are the potential drawbacks that you may want to consider as you try to make this decision. And then they'll be like, but if you don't opt in, you know what your benefits are, they're these things here, but here's the opportunities and benefits you'll be missing if you don't. And they help you, you know, they have someone who will help you understand why you should or shouldn't, and help you make a decision based on your circumstances or whatever, what the best thing to do is. And apparently this is just, there hasn't been a lot of clear communication with the rollout so far, at least. And so we don't really know what the implications are really at this point for already hired professors. This is going to be something that is going to matter to anyone who's hired at BYU going forward. Current professors may opt in or may not, and we don't necessarily know what that means or what the implications are for doing so or not doing so.
Right. As far as moving forward with new employees, this is just my personal opinion, but I do probably think it's a positive move for BYU, because as a member of Brigham Young University, as a member of the church, and as an employee of the church educational system, there is a higher expectation of you to be an example, to be a role model for young Latter-day Saints, to not only reflect the church's standards of behavior, but to reflect the gospel of Jesus Christ itself. And that, as Elder Holland talked about in August at the BYU University Conference, faculty and professors at BYU are expected to live up to their covenants to defend the church, to be standards of righteousness for the church, to be examples to the students. And so I do think it's an important thing for the church to ensure that new faculty members not only behave according to church standards, but truly believe and have a testimony of the reality of the Godhead, of the restoration, the reality of the restoration in the first vision, the Book of Mormon, and that they sustain the prophet and current apostles and all policies, no matter how unpopular they are, that they are fully in, because they are church employees. On the other hand, I don't necessarily envy that position, that if you ever find yourself in a difficult spot where you've made a mistake or gotten into trouble, it's not just your, like, temple recommend at stake. It's potentially
your job. Yeah, I mean, that'd be hard. And I don't know. I don't know. We really maybe shouldn't speculate on how implementation will work in terms of,
like the second your recommend's taken away,
yeah,
does your bishop call the boss?
Do you literally get fired the moment that happens? Is it, you know, if you made some kind of mistake and you're in the repentance process and your recommend is being withheld for a period of time, is that
what kind of leeway, flexibility?
What kind of flexibility is there? We don't know enough about how that is really going to work as of right now. So I agree that in principle I like the idea and I like the policy. It's hard to know exactly. That there's still a lot of questions about how it's going to work. And for those of us who aren't actually employees at BYU, there may very well be questions about it forever because, you know, who knows how public they're going to be in explaining that. Hopefully, employees do get some clarification on these kinds of issues, though.
I do hope so.
And, you know, I think that... I had something, but I think I lost it. Maybe I don't have another contribution to make on that one.
I do hope that BYU is clear in communicating to their faculty about what's expected of them and what are the benefits and drawbacks of taking different actions, because I think that would benefit everyone. BYU's had plenty of experience with positive PR rollouts and negative PR rollouts, and I hope that they are clear and transparent so that there's no confusion.
Right. I just remembered what I was going to say. I know that there are other, like, church-sponsored universities, not sponsored by our church, but other, like, Christian-sponsored universities and stuff, and they handle issues about orthodoxy and things like that in various ways as well. Many of them, I don't know how many, but there are many that will, like, require faculty to sign a doctrinal statement saying, here are the stipulations, something similar to like our articles of faith, for instance. It'll just be a series of doctrinal statements, and you have to either be able to, if you can't affirm those, you know, you are
it's
encouraged.
Not a good fit for you.
You are, yeah, you're not a good fit at the university. That's a good way to put it. And I think, I don't think that this is nearly as restrictive as some of those often are. And, you know, there are different pros and cons to those kinds of universities. And I don't know that I'm necessarily recommending that or discouraging it. It's just the way some other universities do it. But I kind of see this as akin to that for the church, is rather than saying, sign a particular statement with the series of doctrinal affirmations, they're just saying, go to your bishop and affirm specific doctrines and get a temple recommend, and go to your stake president and do the same thing. And they're, it's kind of the similar concept.
Yeah. And I mean, the temple recommend interview questions are in a large way between you and the Lord. I mean, there is some flexibility, and there's a spectrum of belief you can have that fits within the temple recommend questions. And you can still be an Orthodox believing practicing Latter-day Saint and still exist somewhere on a spectrum. But the temple recommend questions still are an attempt to assess some level of orthodoxy and orthopraxy, correct belief and correct behavior. And in addition, I mean, the temple recommend question asks you about your temple covenants. Do you live your temple covenants? And I think that one's a really important one that didn't exist before with just a regular ecclesiastical endorsement, because the temple covers a whole gamut of beliefs and doctrines and behaviors about the way you're going to live your life, the way you treat your spouse, the way you aspire to be a disciple of Jesus Christ can really be encapsulated a lot in those temple covenants. So being asked, do you live your temple covenants and do you, you know, wear the garment? I think that covers a lot of ground pretty easily. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how this goes, or I suppose no news is good news. I mean, if we don't hear anything, maybe it was implemented well and things went smoothly. But we only time will tell. Well, in other news, we've got we don't have as much news from the church, but this last week, members of the church have been studying Genesis 5 through 11, and also Moses chapter 8. And today Neil and I taught that in Sunday school, and we're a few minutes away from hopping into our next hour, where we're going to talk about our assigned Come Follow Me section. But we can just take a couple minutes right here to talk about some of our thoughts on Noah's Ark. I mean, we've gotten plenty of questions over the last week from various people or individuals or online about, was the flood global? Was it literal? What's the moral of the story of the flood? Why is it repetitive? I mean, there's a whole slew of questions one could be addressing and answering when it comes to Noah's Ark and the flood. But it was fun today to get the perspectives of some 17-year-olds and how they feel about these issues and the importance of following the prophet and the importance of token covenants. I mean, that was one of the things that the Come Follow Me manual emphasized, was, you know, talk about how God made the rainbow as a token of his covenant with Noah. And that one's fun to talk about with youth, because people who have gone through the temple understand more concretely the connection between tokens and covenants, and that God often accompanies covenants with special symbols and signs and ritual actions. And so it's kind of fun to introduce those concepts to teenagers who maybe don't fully understand the implications it'll have later on in their worship, but are learning, and they get it. They understand the importance of having those things of those memorials of important events in their lives, or the memorials of promises they made to someone or to God. Do you have any thoughts, Neil, on Noah's Ark in the last couple minutes here?
Well, I would just draw people's attention to the recent Noah that was published on Book of Mormon Central. I think it's a worthwhile read and interesting to take a look at. The question it asks is, why is the story of Noah and the Ark so repetitive? And it talks a little bit about, it doesn't go into great depth, but it talks about some of the repetition that's in the story, and some of the different ways scholars have tried to resolve that solution. A popular solution among scholars has been to split the text up into separate sources, usually into two sources, and argue that we actually have two different versions of the flood story here, and that they have some different details and things like that. But there are some scholars who argue that no, there actually is a cohesive whole narrative here. Whatever the sources behind the text may be, there's a cohesive whole narrative, and several scholars, and I was actually really surprised at how many scholars came to this conclusion completely independently of one another in really close succession. There were two who published on this in 1978 without knowing about each other's work, and then there was another one who published on it in 1981 without knowing about the other two's work. And there was also one who did it in 1979 who didn't know about anybody else's work. So a bunch of scholars kind of came to a consensus on this inadvertently, unexpectedly, unaware of each other's work, that there was a chiastic pattern here. And I assume that our audience here with Interpreter is familiar with the concept of chiasmus, where the story starts at a point and it tells a series of details till it climaxes at a central moment and then reverses those details in reverse order. And the exact chiastic arrangement from these different scholars varies a little bit. They didn't all come up with the exact same chiasm all at once, but they did all recognize the exact same central element, which is Genesis 8:1, God remembers Noah. And so there's several things, you know, the story kind of begins with God pledging to destroy all flesh, right? I'm going to destroy everything except Noah and his family and the animals that he saves. And then it goes through all this series of details. It talks about 7 days waiting for the flood, 40 days for flooding, 150 days that the waters prevail. And then God remembers Noah. And after that, 150 days, the waters abate, and you kind of see this complete undoing of everything that was just done. The waters recede for 40 days. There's 7 days waiting on the water to subside. There's several other details I'm really just highlighting. This is actually a massive chiasm. There's 31 different elements in it. It's very large, but it culminates in this covenant that Jasmine's talking about, where instead of destroying all flesh, now God covenants to preserve all flesh and never again destroy the world in a cataclysmic way like this. And I really like the observation. There's a lot of cool observations. The first half of the chiasm is a undoing of creation. The second half of the chiasm is a recreation. And things like that, really cool insights along those lines. But the central element being God remembering Noah, I think, has the most potent theological implications, as it draws our focus away from this destructive and the wickedness of the people and the destructive acts and things like that. And this is a quote from Yehuda Radai, who was a Jewish scholar. He passed away some years ago. I don't know exactly when, but in his 1981 article, he said that by having this element in the center, the stress is laid not on the sinful generation, but on the one Zadik, which is Hebrew for righteous. It's not on drowning, but on survival. The world, so the story proclaims, does not exist because of the great many evildoers, not even in spite of them, but for the sake of those like Noah. Be there even but one in a generation who follows his conscience and does as commanded. Thanks to him, God's mercy prevails over his wrath, and the world is saved. And so this really does, it draws our attention away from the cataclysmic destruction and helps us see that really the central focus is God's mercy towards the righteous. And that's everything. So go check that out at BookofMormonCentral.org.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome back to The Interpreter Show. Once again, I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by my lovely wife, Jasmine. And just as a reminder, The Interpreter Show is sponsored by The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by LDSAgents.com, a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality real estate agents serving Latter-day Saints nationwide and in Canada for more than 20 years. Whether you're buying or selling a home, be in touch with LDSAgents.com. Their professional, friendly real estate agents will help you find just the home you're looking for that meets your needs in a safe neighborhood with the right schools and a temple not far away. Now it's easier to find a real estate agent who speaks your language and shares your values. Whether you are buying or selling, no matter where you are, let LDSAgents.com reduce the stress of your move. That's LDSAgents.com. So that is our sponsor. And now we have come to our second hour, which is the Come Follow Me portion of our show. This particular week, we will be covering the final chapters of Genesis 42 through 50. This is, of course, mid-Joseph cycle. we're going to be picking up right in the middle here, but very, very good stuff here.
It really is some of the best stuff in the book of Genesis as far as storytelling goes. In many ways, the entire book of Genesis kind of culminates in this very narrative retelling of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, if you will. Neil and I were just
talking... Keep in mind, Technicolor is almost certainly a mistranslation.
Oh, absolutely. Neil and I were talking over dinner just today about how there's such a stark contrast between the narrative style between Genesis and Exodus. And even though theoretically they're coming from the same source tradition, there really is just such a stark difference between the exciting adventures, very literary style of Genesis, especially these culminating Joseph stories. Once you hit Exodus, it gets very fast paced, and Moses is born, and burning bush, and plagues, Israel's delivered, and then 20 more chapters of legal texts and tabernacle liturgical texts, and it gets really dry really fast. But these last chapters of Genesis are just an absolute delight. I love the Joseph story. It might be my favorite in all of Genesis because it is so narrative, it is very literary, but it's also touching. It's got a lot of pathos.
It's very emotive. It's a very... the reunion between Joseph and his brothers is just... I will confess to crying at times when I have read this. It's
very
so good.
Touching, and in some ways, it's fun to compare and contrast the different patriarchs and just the different characters in Genesis with Joseph, because I feel like in some ways, Joseph's like the only truly unadulterated, purely good guy in the entire book of Genesis. All the other major patriarchs are wonderful. They've become prophets. They become great people, but they all have flaws of one thing or another. They mess up or they make mistakes or they fall back into bad habits. Whereas Joseph is just like pure, squeaky clean from the get-go and just a real virtuous person.
If Joseph has a flaw, it's being naive at times, right?
Maybe being just a little precocious or presumptuous.
Yeah, he's very presumptuous with his dreams at the beginning of the story, but that's not in our section, so we don't have to talk about it. He's so genuinely good, and I really love the story. And, you know, there's some drama involved in that, too, because when Joseph is first meeting his brothers again for the first time, there's this tension of, like, okay, how is he going to react? It's the same. It actually goes back when, if you go back into Genesis 32 and 33, when Jacob is reuniting with Esau for the first time, which is also just a very powerful, very beautiful story as far as I'm concerned. And there's this tension. How is Esau going to react? Well, that tension carries over here, where it's like, okay, Joseph is now confronted with his brothers who sold him into Egypt.
Who wanted to kill him.
Who wanted to kill him. Who resented him and hated him. And they don't know he's their brother, but he knows who they are.
There's a lot of dramatic irony.
And there's this question, how is he going to react? Is he going to seek revenge? Is he going to... is he going to try and make him pay? Is he going to What is he going to do? How is he going to react to this? And
you don't really get the answer to that question until the end. I mean, obviously, many of us know how the story goes, but it's not like he tells you his motive or his incentive up front. The narrator doesn't cue you into what Joseph's thinking. You're just seeing Joseph having his brothers jump through a bunch of hoops, and you're like, well, what's his angle? What's he going to do? Is he trying to trip them up? Is he trying to catch them so he can imprison them? Or is he trying to, like, forgive them? What's going on here? And it really strings you along until the climactic reveal of his character.
Absolutely. Very good stuff. And so, I don't know, do we want to give a, kind of an overview for these chapters really quickly? Or
great idea. So we're doing chapters 42 to 50 to give a little bit of background. The Joseph story really starts in Genesis chapter 37. When Joseph starts to become of age, he has visions and dreams. His brothers resent him for it because his dreams are all about how he will rule over them one day. And his brothers decide to conspire against him. They sell him into Egypt. Joseph ends up in Potiphar's house, being a household servant. He escapes being seduced by Potiphar's wife, but ends up being framed for it, so is cast into prison. The Pharaoh has a bunch of dreams about an upcoming famine, but can't interpret them. Joseph interprets these dreams correctly as foretelling a famine, and also gives Pharaoh a plan of action on how to prepare. It is at this point that Pharaoh gives Joseph a considerable amount of power in the land of Egypt to execute this vision for establishing some agricultural practices and infrastructure to prepare Egypt for a time of famine. We enter chapter 41 when there's a famine in the land of Egypt, or rather, chapter 42 when the famine really comes into the land of Egypt, and that's where our story picks up. So Joseph has now been estranged from his brothers for well over a decade.
I think it's 17 years.
That sounds about right.
Is the in the biblical timeline.
He's been estranged from his brothers, and it's at this point in the story that the 10 brothers come down to Egypt. There are originally 12 brothers, but one of them is Joseph, who they sold to Egypt, and the youngest Benjamin does not come along because he is Jacob's other favorite son. So the brothers come down to Egypt, and Joseph sees them, knows exactly who they are, and decides to play a little bit of disguise to kind of just see where they're at, probe them a little bit before revealing, and that covers chapters 42 through 44. Those three chapters are Joseph having his brothers jump through certain hoops and kind of testing them and trying to figure out what their angle is. Are they good people, or are they as horrible as I remembered them 17 years ago? And he sets some elaborate traps for them, too. It's quite interesting. Until chapter 44, when Judah pleads for Joseph's forgiveness. Joseph reveals himself in this really emotional scene. And then the final five chapters of Genesis are kind of an extended resolution and epilogue. Joseph gets permission from Pharaoh to invite his family to come live with him in Egypt. The Pharaoh approves them to live in the land of Goshen. So Jacob comes down into Egypt in his old age, gets reunited with his beloved lost son Joseph in another emotional, touching scene. And Jacob eventually dies, but before he does so, he gives final blessings to all 12 of his children and to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. After Jacob gives the final blessings to his children, he passes away. He is buried in the land of Canaan. They take a big journey up to Canaan to bury the father, but then everyone comes back down to Egypt. There's a final confrontation between the brothers and Joseph. And then finally, chapter 50 briefly retells how Joseph is also eventually dies and is embalmed in Egypt. And that is where the Exodus picks up. So we actually have quite a bit of story to cover, though most of the action does take place in those first three chapters. And the rest of it, like I said, is an extended resolution and epilogue, including final patriarchal blessings that kind of really conclude not just the Joseph story, but the entire book of Genesis. This idea that the whole book was an introduction to the house of Israel, and then we end the book with blessings on the house of Israel. So, really cool stuff. Now let's dive in and take this a little bit more at a slow pace. So in chapter 42, as I mentioned earlier, we start in Canaan where there is a famine. And in verse 1, it talks about how Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt. So he essentially tells his sons to get up hence and go there. But he held Benjamin back and said Benjamin should not go with the brothers to Egypt, lest peradventure mischief befall him. Because, of course, the reader knows that his other brother, Joseph, had mischief befall him in chapter 37. And so all of this really just kind of, I don't know, the whole story is constantly hearkening back to Joseph's story in chapter 37. Jacob's constantly referring back to or alluding or echoing how Joseph was stolen from him. Therefore, he's more protective of Benjamin. And Joseph constantly is reflecting back on that earlier episode. The brothers are constantly reflecting back. So it's good to be keeping in mind all of what we learned in chapter 37 and 39. To contrast with what we're seeing in these chapters, because there's a lot of very clever literary juxtaposition. So when the brothers arrive in Egypt, Joseph, in chapter verse 7, it says, Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, we're from the land of Canaan. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land are ye come. They have this conversation where they go back and forth, and they say, no, there's 12 of us because we're all brothers, and our father's in Canaan. And then Joseph pushes on them.
He kind of seizes on that discrepancy in number.
He
says, there's 12 of you, but there's only 10 of you here.
Exactly. And then they have to explain, oh, well, the youngest one's back home because the dad really loves him and he's protective of him. And Joseph, like you said, kind of exploits that discrepancy since he knows very well the family dynamics and essentially says, you need to, before I give you grain, you need to go and get that brother so I know you're telling the truth. That's the only way I'm going to know that you're being honest with me. And they protest, they're like, but he's like the favorite son, he'll never let us come and bring Benjamin. And so what Joseph ends up doing is imprisoning them. He says, send one of you and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved. And so he put them in prison for 3 days. And then eventually he kind of relents a little bit. Well, he renegotiates and say, okay, let one of your brethren be bound here in prison as a ransom. And the rest of you go back. And when you come for corn next time or for grain next time, come and bring Benjamin back. And then I'll let your other brother go.
If I could just interject for a moment, just backing up in the story to verse 13. This is where they're replying to him and they're saying, yeah, we're 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Our youngest is still with our father. And they add, and one is no longer alive. Or the more literal from the Hebrew is one is not. And this is an instance where that drama and irony is playing out in the story. This one that they think is no longer. And I think I've been reading this in Robert Alter's Bible and Bible translation. And I think he puts no longer there or is not. He doesn't tack on alive. He thinks that it's actually being deliberately left ambiguous because the brothers themselves don't actually know what happened to him. They sold him into Egypt and they just, as far as they're aware, he's just no more. They don't know that he's dead for sure, but he's just no longer. He's gone. He is not. But there's this irony here that they're actually talking to that brother, and Joseph knows this, and they don't.
There's a lot of irony and repetition of the disguise motif as well. Joseph talks about how he made himself strange unto them so that they wouldn't recognize him. I mean, in our popular adaptations of this story, we often just kind of see how Joseph is an Egyptian garb, and so they don't recognize him because he's got the eye makeup on, and he's got, like, a pharaoh's crown on, all this anachronistic stuff, and all this, like, pretty inaccurate costuming, but still, I mean, it's not hard to believe that after 17 years, he would have looked very different. It could have been easy to just ensure that his brothers didn't recognize him. But what I find significant is that it's kind of an echo of the Jacob story, because Jacob initially has his comeuppance because he employs some disguise. He steals Esau's firstborn blessing by disguising as Esau, by covering himself in hair and bringing the game to his father Isaac. And then Isaac blesses Jacob instead of Esau, and this causes decades of Jacob suffering for that, because Esau's upset, and so Jacob has to run away from home. And then he spends all that time with Laban. Laban eventually cheats him through a disguise. He disguises Leah as Rachel. And so then Jacob has to go through 7 additional years of labor with Laban. And there's all sorts of stuff. So you've got multiple motifs where someone's disguising themselves in order to gain some sort of advantage. And it usually doesn't end up in their favor. And it usually ends up kind of messy. But now Jacob, who doted on his precious son Joseph, has lost him. And now Joseph is kind of playing into his father's ploys of disguising himself. In this case, we the reader are uncertain what to make of it. If you've never heard the story before, you're just reading this, and like I mentioned earlier, we're not sure what Joseph's motive is. The narrator doesn't cue us into what Joseph's thinking, what he wants to do with his brothers, if he has malicious intent or positive intent. And so from a first reading perspective, you might assume that Joseph's falling into the same trap that his father Jacob did, of disguising to get some sort of advantage, and it may backfire on him. But of course, those who know the story know that that's not at all what's happening, and that Joseph's trying to test or prove his brothers, to find their valor and eventually reconcile with them.
And you know, it even, as far as Joseph's disguise goes, we even learn in verse 23 that the brothers talk openly in front of him because they don't actually know.
It's funny. It's like
that
humorous.
He can speak their language, that he knows their Canaanite language, whatever they were speaking at the time. Hebrew wouldn't have been invented, but hadn't developed. You don't really invent a language, but they're speaking some kind of Canaanite language, and he speaks to them through an interpreter. So they assume he's Egyptian and he doesn't know what they're saying. And that's all part of his disguise. But the narrator here is cluing us in that he's actually, Jacob is, or Joseph is actually overhearing the conversation as they talk with one another. And this is part of how he's trying to figure out, okay, what kind of people are they now? He's listening in, he's eavesdropping on their conversations. He wants them to not know that he knows what they're saying, so that they feel at ease and are being themselves. That's all part of, you know, kind of what's going on here.
In fact, the brothers visit Egypt 2 times, once here in 42 and then again in chapter 43. And these 2 times that the brothers visit represent 2 major tests that Joseph is giving his brothers. And as we find out later, the tests were meant, as Neil said, to assess where the brothers are at. Have their hearts changed? Have they overcome the resentment they held for Joseph before? Do they love each other? Do they love him? Like, where are they at? And so the way he does that in these 2 chapters is by recreating his own imprisonment. They sold him into Egypt, into slavery. And so he's going to do the same thing to his brothers, or he's going to like mimic it. So first, he imprisons all the brothers, and he imprisons Simeon specifically as a ransom and says, okay, go get your other brother. In the meantime, I'm keeping Simeon. And what we learn about later in the chapter is that he returns the money that the brothers brought into their sacks. So when they go home with their new grain from Egypt, Joseph also stowed away the money that they gave Joseph back into their grain bags, so that they essentially stole the grain unbeknownst to them. So because they took back the money and he kept Simeon, it almost even kind of made it seem like Simeon was sold into slavery per se. It's kind of like an echo of that motif. And so in this instance, Joseph's testing, okay, I've got you, I've imprisoned your brother, one you love, and one from Leah, and I've sold him into slavery. What are you going to do about it? What's going to happen? Are they going to forget him? Are they going to leave them there? I mean, we assume that the time period between the first arrival in Egypt and the second one has got to be at the very least a month or so, and probably even more. And so poor Simeon is there waiting for a long time, and Joseph's kind of sitting on edge too. What's going to happen? Are they going to forget him and abandon him like they abandoned him, or are they going to return and do whatever they can to recover their long lost brother? So let's see. We're now in the late 20s of chapter 42. Okay, so the brothers get back home to Canaan, and they report everything that happened to their father. And they said, sorry, Dad, but we need to take Benjamin with us because they held Simeon hostage. And understandably, this did not go over well with Jacob. He lost Joseph, then the brothers lost Simeon, and now they're asking him to lose Benjamin. Well, from Jacob's perspective, it feels like he's losing three sons in one go. And so you can't blame Jacob, I suppose, for being really upset about all of this, but there's just really interesting family dynamics going on. And it's also interesting to see some of the specific brother interactions. You've got, consistently throughout the story, Reuben and Judah are the ones who kind of pipe up and either defend Joseph or try to soften the blows. In chapter 37, both Reuben and Judah make separate attempts to stop Joseph from falling into harm. And then here, again in chapter 42, it's Reuben who says, who makes a vow to ensure Benjamin's safety. Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. And so he put the stakes really high. Look, I know you've lost Joseph, and you're looking at losing a second son. So slay my two sons if I don't come through with my end of the bargain. Fortunately, it does not come to that, but eventually, initially Jacob says, no, that's not happening. But eventually, the hunger wins out because the famine doesn't end. Joseph knew that the famine was going to last 7 years, but theoretically, Jacob and his family didn't know that. And so, sure enough, the famine doesn't end. They're still hungry. They run out of grain. And so before you know it, they've got to go back to Egypt. And so in chapter 43, the brothers kind of remind him, we can't go back without Benjamin. And it's at that point that Jacob finally does relent and allows Benjamin to go with them. It's fun that the brothers kind of recognize themselves that this was a recreation of Joseph's imprisonment. When they're in the prison and Joseph is like eavesdropping on them in chapter 42, it talks about how they said to one another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. So the characters themselves are pointing out that we should be noticing similarities between Joseph's imprisonment and their imprisonment. They're like, oh man, this is happening to us because we imprisoned Joseph. Now we're imprisoned.
I'm trying to find where Reuben talks about his vow to, where is that exactly?
Oh, sorry. In chapter 42, this is the very last two verses, verse 37.
Oh, right. Yeah. So there is this pledge from Reuben, but there is also one from Judah, and Judah, in verse 8 through 9 and 10,
of 43,
Judah says, send the boy with me and we will go immediately. Then we will live and not die. And we and you and our little ones, I myself pledge security for him. And I'm reading, I should maybe let people know, I'm not reading from the KJV. I'm reading from the Net Bible. If I do not bring him back to you and place him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all of my life. And there's a difference in his pledge versus Reuben's in that Jacob replies to Reuben's pledge by saying, by refusing, right? He says, my son will not go down with you there, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. And I can't remember. I wish I could remember the commentary from Robert Alter a little better, but he kind of talks about how this is not really a very comforting thought for for Jacob, because it's like, okay, so you you would have me lose not just my
three sons, but
two of my grandsons as well. That's your solution to this problem. And so then it's Judah's plea who says, look, not my sons, nobody else, I will bear the blame if we lose him. I will carry that all my life. And, you know, he kind of stresses, if we had not delayed, we could have traveled there and back twice by now. He kind of is chiding his dad, like, we could have been there by now. And so it's after this that actually Jacob agrees, or Israel agrees, to let them go. And it had never occurred to me before what might be going on with these two, both in the original story with Reuben and then Judah trying to save Joseph, and then Reuben and then Judah offering to protect Benjamin. And as we go on in the story, we'll see the intervention of Judah is what ultimately prevails as well on Joseph. It had never ever occurred to me before what is going on here, but this may very well be part of the explanation from the Judahite perspective of why Reuben, who's actually the oldest, is not the leading tribe and is not the tribe from whence the monarchy emerges and things like that, but rather Judah. This is kind of a polemic, if you will. I don't know. That's maybe not quite the right
folk
word, but
ideology.
But it's a story about how or why Judah has come to prominence and ultimately gained the right to rule over all Israel. Because
and Reuben's not necessarily pinned as the bad guy in the story, because he does try to speak up in 37 and protect Joseph from harm. And here again, he's trying to be an advocate for the family and take that role. But like you said, Judah kind of comes up on top as being the superior moral voice.
It's not a bad guy so much as I think kind of ineptitude. Like, you see what you see going on is Reuben trying to step up and lead, but doing a poor job of it, and Judah being the one who steps into his place and successfully is able to take on that role and lead the brothers.
It is interesting because Jacob, in his final blessing to Reuben, you know, explicitly specifies why Reuben didn't become the superior brother, is because he slept with Jacob's wife, Bilhah. And so that's why he lost his birthright. That's why it goes to Judah. And so you've got like a pretty explicit reason there. And so this is just additional kind of bolstering of that character choice. But Judah also doesn't exactly have a squeaky clean history either, because even though he's kind of showing some penance in this story with his treatment of Joseph, we know very well in Genesis 38, you've got the Judah and Tamar story, where Judah does not treat his daughter-in-law very well. He refuses to give his sons keep dying as they wed Judah's daughter-in-law. And so he's understandably reticent to give his youngest son to his daughter-in-law to marry. But when he doesn't do that, she takes matters into her own hands, and he accidentally sleeps with her. Well, not so accidentally, but inadvertently to him, she also tricks him in a disguise. We've got lots of disguises in Genesis. And then she gets pregnant, and he has to bear the consequence of that. And it's through that line that eventually David and Jesus Christ comes. So it's very interesting.
So, yeah. And in fact, in regard to that story, I know that story is placed in Genesis 38, and so it actually kind of is disruptive to the Joseph narrative, because the Joseph narrative starts in 37, and then we get that story, and then it picks up again in 39. And lots of people have... It's strategically juxtaposed with Joseph's very righteous refusal of Potiphar's wife's advances and things like that, and it it's meant to highlight Judah's failings in contrast to that in important ways. But, and I don't know if I've ever seen anyone talk about this. Maybe some people have, this may not be an original insight, and maybe there are other people who have talked about it, but you also can contrast that with Reuben sleeping with Bilhah. And they're both instances of sexual misbehavior and impropriety, but the conclusion of Genesis 38 is Judah recognizing his follies and basically repenting and trying to do right by Tamar in the end. And so I think, again, there's kind of they're just subtly trying to show you that Judah is actually the better moral character and the better leader. Reuben's not a bad guy. He just doesn't quite rise to the occasion the way Judah does. So
this is a thought that Hales had, actually, but it kind of connects to some of the moral... Well, one of the larger questions of this story is why Joseph comes off as this just stellar, immaculate character. He is so great. He is so awesome. And we're concluding the story of Genesis, the story of the beginning of the house of Israel, with Joseph. And then the rest of the Bible is all about Judah in a lot of ways, or about the rest of the Israelites. And Joseph doesn't appear hardly at all anywhere else in the Bible. He's mentioned just very sparsely. So much of the focus of the rest of the biblical narrative, especially the historical works, are about David and his kingdom that he brought forth and his line, and how Judah, the scepter will come forth of Judah, and all these prophecies about how important the Judahite kingdom is. And so it kind of feels a little odd that Judah has kind of a sordid origin story, and Joseph is put up as this pinnacle of righteousness, and then yet nothing ever happens to Joseph. It's all about Judah. And Hales pointed out, he couldn't join us on the show today, that the JST in Genesis 48, which we'll talk more about later, kind of brings the focus to the restoration. Because it's true. It would be so odd if Joseph had he had all these unfulfilled promises and all this unfulfilled potential, but it's through the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ that Joseph does receive his fulfillment of those promises, and namely through the Book of Mormon, because Lehi talks about how he comes from the tribe of Manasseh, and there are a number of prophecies that are fulfilled through Lehi's seed and the Book of Mormon, populating the Americas, bringing the gospel there, having Jesus Christ minister to their seed. And so in a lot of ways, the legacy of the Book of Genesis comes through the Book of Mormon, and not necessarily through the Bible, which focuses a lot more on Judah's descendants. But we'll talk more about that at a later point when we get to the rest of that. So at the end of Genesis 43, Jacob finally agrees to send all of the sons back to Egypt, including Benjamin. And this is where test number two begins. Joseph once again is going to try to recreate his imprisonment, except this time the brothers have already proven that they're good enough to come back for Simeon. And they were good enough to come back at the very least because of their empty bellies. They had an incentive. They were hungry. They needed more food. Therefore, they're going to come and save Simeon. So Joseph heightens the stakes on this next test by introducing the element of the favorite son, Benjamin. Well, they came back for Simeon, Leah's son, their comrade and their full brother. What's going to happen if I put Benjamin at risk? What's going to happen then? So once the brothers arrive in Egypt at the end of chapter 43, they get an entirely different reception than they got in 42. In the Genesis 42, Joseph treated them with suspicion and treated them as spies. When Joseph greets them this time, or rather the steward greets them, they are welcomed with open arms and they're invited into Joseph's home as honored guests. And they're treated not nearly so suspiciously as foreigners would be, but rather they're treated in a familial, intimate way because Joseph needs to get closer to them for his next test to work. They brought them to Joseph's house, they gave him water, washed their feet, took care of their animals, and then they come for the great meal, And when Joseph finally came, his first thought is he's so happy to see them and he wants to inquire about his father. So he says, "Is your father well? Is he still alive? How's he doing?" And they say, "Yes, he's still alive. We're so grateful to be here. And is your brother here? Is Benjamin here?" And he said, "Yes." And so Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother. And as soon as he saw his brother Benjamin, it says that he was overcome with emotion. So he had to go back to his room and kind of weep and recompose himself. And it's just another one of those moments of just the dramatic tension in the air of what's Joseph trying to do here? Why is he crying? Is he crying because he missed his brothers? Or is he crying because he's still so hurt by the situation? But then he sees Benjamin, and you can only assume that this is just emotion out of his love for his full brother of his mother, because he and Benjamin were both sons of Rachel. All the rest were sons of Leah or one of the other handmaids. And so his full brother he saw for the first time in 17 years, he's just overcome. It's a really beautiful moment.
And it's so detailed. I mean, it talks about him becoming overcome to the point of tears. So he goes out of the room. I mean, we've all experienced those moments, right? Where someone,
can't take it anymore.
Someone's so overcome and they leave the room and you're just kind of like, okay. But he goes out of the room, it talks about him washing his face. He cleans up to make it look like he hasn't been crying, doesn't want him to know. And then with composure, he goes back out. Like, it's so real. It's so human. I really love it.
I love it. And this is where he starts to test the brothers, because once again, Benjamin is the favorite son here. And Joseph knows this, even though the brothers don't know that Joseph knows. Well, I guess Joseph technically did hear the brothers talking about this, but Joseph deliberately treats Benjamin as the favorite. And he kind of amazes them, because when he sits them down to eat, it says they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled at one another. So this is Joseph again kind of pulling the wool over their eyes, because he knows exactly who's the oldest and the age order of all of his brothers, because they're his brothers. But the brothers don't know that Joseph knows this. And so they're like, whoa, he set us an age order. What? How did he do this? And in the next verse, it says, and he took and sent their messes unto them, their food. And Benjamin's food was five times as much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him. So this is an instance where Joseph is trying to show very clear favoritism to Benjamin. Now, this may just have been natural, because as we just saw, Joseph was overcome with emotion. He loves Benjamin. He wants to show him that affection. But I think there's also the ulterior aspect of him wanting to test his brothers. He tested to see if the brothers would come back for Simeon. Check. Now he's coming back to see, have the brothers overcome their resentment of their father's favoritism? If Jacob has a flaw, one of them is that he did show favoritism to his son Joseph, and that caused some family tension. And since Jacob also showed a lot of favoritism towards Benjamin, that I'm sure caused plenty of family strife and resentment. And so Joseph is now testing, regardless of what our father did, have you as human beings overcome that resentment? Have you overcome that jealousy? And what's going to happen when I put this favorite son at risk? So that's chapter 43. Now is chapter 44. We close the scene on the dinner. The brothers are getting ready to return back to Canaan with their food and with Simeon. It sounds like everything is back to normal. The whole gang's back together, minus Joseph, obviously, and they're about to head back. Well, Joseph pulls the same trick he pulled earlier. He takes all of their money and returns it to their sacks. But this time, instead of just returning their money to them, unbeknownst to them, he secreted his silver cup into Benjamin's sack. He stowed away his silver cup, and this isn't just any cup.
It's the cup he uses for divination.
It's his divining cup. It says in verse 1 of chapter 44, he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put every man's money in his sack's mouth, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest and his corn money. And he did according to the words Joseph has spoken. So it's just a silver cup right now. But then once the brothers leave, Joseph basically says, as soon as they had gotten a certain distance, he told the steward, okay, go after the brothers and apprehend them, because you know exactly what we just did. So when the servant catches up with the brothers, the steward says, Joseph tells the steward to tell the brothers, once you catch up with them, kind of give them a hard time about it. Why have you done evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh? And whereby indeed he divineth, ye have done evil in so doing. And that King James language essentially communicates. The steward was to apprehend them and say, why did you steal the divination cup from Joseph after he treated you so well and all the money?
We talk a lot about what the brothers must have been thinking during all this, but what was the steward thinking?
Were
Joseph's servants? They must have been really confused. Like, what is he doing?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Do we want to talk about divination and divining cups?
Absolutely. So, narratively, what's happening here is... Joseph, once again, he's doing this major test where he's trying to recreate his imprisonment. And I think he's doing it in a really interesting way with the silver cup, because by pinning Benjamin with the silver cup, he's casting Benjamin as his surrogate. He's casting him as himself, because Joseph is the dreamer. Joseph is the one with the spiritual gifts. And divination is kind of a loaded word, but it just means someone who's able to interpret supernatural signs from God or from a divine source. And Joseph has already established himself as a diviner of dreams. From his youth, he had dreams given to him by God that he was able to interpret. He was able to do it again for the Pharaoh. And so he's established himself as someone who has these spiritual gifts.
Yeah.
And so by pinning an object of these spiritual gifts on Benjamin, he's kind of like symbolically saying, the narrator is saying, this is the Joseph person in this story. He's the surrogate.
And I think it is, I mean, later in the Bible, you get a lot of polemic against divination, and it's kind of this thing that gets lambasted a lot. And so the impression sometimes is that divination in and of itself is this wrong thing to do. But as is often the case in the ancient world, and really even in religion today, things are wrong when they're not done by the right people, right? It's magic when other people do it. When God's people do it, right? And there are plenty of things, examples of things where we could say it's actually wrong to do if you don't actually have the proper priesthood authority and things like that. But like even things like, even though the Bible uses polemics against divination and that kind of thing, then you have things like the Urim and Thummim, which are divination tools, right?
Right. They designed... were likely sacred lots, or the high priest would have these stones and he would cast them and they would be able to tell him answers to his questions that he puts to the Lord. And that's a form of divination.
And the difference, of course, being that like the high priest is the one that God has designated to communicate with and speak to. So when he does divination, there's nothing wrong with it. But
we even see it a little bit in the Book of Mormon when Nephi goes to get the plates from Laban and his brothers. They cast lots to see who will go in to see Laban. And we just see that as like pulling straws. But in the ancient world, casting lots was a religious matter. I mean, if you dedicate your lots to God, whatever comes out is God's will sort of thing. And again, I mean, the Liahona is kind of an object of divination because it's telling them where to go. They ask the Liahona questions and it tells them where to go for food. And so there's a little bit of that going on there as well. Yeah. And like you mentioned, the Urim and Thummim.
Right. And the point just being, though, that it's always, the issue is always unauthorized use of this kind of stuff. The issue when there's these polemics against these practices is these are people who are trying to go outside the proper lines of authority and seek other ways to work around God's way of doing things, right? And to divine things from outside that proper authority structure. And so divination in and of itself, the point being, not bad. God's prophets do it. God's high priest does it. The people who are authorized are doing it. It's when you are doing it to try and work around. And, you know, an example that comes to mind is Saul seeking the witch of Endor, right? Like, he's trying to work around God's actual authorized processes. But of course, he's also trying to summon the dead prophet Samuel. So
there's some seedy stuff going
on there. It's a little odd, but anyway, we can get back to the narrative here.
With the silver cup, what's likely happening is a type of divination called lecanomancy, and that's just a fancy Greek word to refer to the liquid form of divination. So someone would put water in the cup, but also mix it with oil, and a diviner or someone skilled in this art could look at the patterns that the oil made in the water to determine a yes or no answer when they put a question to God. We talked about the Urim and Thummim with stones. Using divination with stones is called cleromancy in some studies. And so it happens in different ways and in different forms.
Should we call using the Liahona, Liahonamancy? There's not really a word for it, but I will say this, it's got arrows in it, right? And Hugh Nibley compared it to bellomancy, which is divining using arrows, where the Arabs and things would, and other peoples would, they would have two arrows, two sticks that they would put together and they'd cast down, and the one with the point on the end, where it was pointing, that would tell you which way to go. So,
and I mean, Latter-day Saints even have a very light form of this as well. I mean, have you ever had a question you had or a trial you were going through, and at some point or another, I'm sure someone has said to you, or you've thought to yourself, just open up the scriptures to any place in the scriptures, and whatever you fall on, you know, that's a message God wants you to have. And sure enough, sometimes you're like, oh, wow, that it was an answer to my prayer or whatever. I mean, that's kind of a form of
Could we call it scriptomancy?
Scriptomancy. I mean, whatever you do when you're seeking a divine sign from God, you're hoping for some answer to your prayer, and it comes through natural means, or it comes through different forms. It's not always coming through direct revelation. Sometimes it's coming through the scriptures, and you find it in an unconventional way. I mean, like you said, I mean, divination's kind of a scary word, but it's any way that we interpret signs from God, and there are authorized ways to do it, and there are unauthorized ways to do it. And so, anyway, that's a kind of a tangent on this story, but the whole point being that the cup pins Benjamin as the surrogate Joseph, the second Joseph. Once they bring the brothers back, they're apprehended and they're all confused. And Joseph, of course, is now acting very angry, and they search the sacks, and of course it falls on Benjamin. And then in verse 13, it says, then they rent their clothes. And they were just so distraught that it happened to be Benjamin, because of course the one person they weren't supposed to lose is the one they're going to lose, and they're very stressed over this. And Joseph questions them, why have you done this? Don't you know that a man such as I can certainly divine? There's that divination word again. Like, how did you think you could get away with this? Of course I knew it. I'm a diviner. I could divine that you stole this. No, Joseph, you literally just framed them. But, you know, he's setting up the scene and making it very dramatic. And it's at this point that Joseph essentially says, because Benjamin was caught with the cup, you have done this horrible thing. I'm going to imprison you. And Judas says, please, no, don't do that. We are just your Lord's servants. And
he talks about, he says, God has exposed the sin of your servants. And this is an allusion back to their selling Joseph in the first place, right?
It's true. Eventually, Joseph says, not all of you need to be imprisoned. I'm just going to keep Benjamin. Again, recreating his own imprisonment. I'm going to imprison the favorite son, even though this was a hard sell to get Jacob to let you do this, and you bet your own lives on this. I'm taking Benjamin. And this is when the tension of the story comes to its head. What's going to happen? Are the brothers going to let it happen? Is Joseph going to go through with his bluff? Or what's going to happen? And Judah comes forward, and Judah comes through in this really impassioned speech. Like you said, Neil, this is a very detailed story, and this is one of those detailed moments where Judah comes across as very sympathetic and impassioned and emotive and full of pathos. And he begs Joseph that, no, please take me in his place, because this is my father's favorite son. And he essentially recounts the whole Joseph story. It's his confession.
It's very detailed. Yeah, and it's...
He's acknowledging what he did wrong. He's like, look, please don't do this to my father. He's suffered enough. I don't want to cause my father any suffering, and here's why. I sold my brother out into Egypt. I did this. I did that. And it's been horrible, and my father has suffered, and I can't take... Like, it's eating me, the misery and the distress of it. Please... I'm begging you, let me suffer in his place. This is all my fault. And it's just beautiful. It is absolutely pathetic in the correct term. It's full of pathos. And as soon as...
That takes us all the way to the end of 44, yeah. Is Judah's speech.
And we won't go through it because we're really almost out of time. But as soon as he does that, Joseph, again, becomes overwhelmed, cries, hides himself in his room because he can't stand it anymore.
Well, he doesn't. He doesn't hide himself in the room, but he tells his Egyptian servants.
Right.
He says, in verse 40, chapter 45, verses 1 through 1 and 2, it says he's not able to control himself. So he says, everyone go out from my presence. But he is just talking about the attendants to leave. And no one remained with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept loudly, so loudly, that the Egyptians heard it, and Pharaoh's household heard it. And it was, he's completely overcome, and he's weeping. And this is where he reveals to them, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?
And the brothers could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. Understatement of the whole book.
The Net Bible here uses dumbfounded. They were dumbfounded before him.
And then he again repeats, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near. He said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. And then he talks about how don't be grieved or angry with yourselves, for God did send me before you to preserve life. And this is where it's revealed that Joseph wasn't doing this to trick them or to trap them. He was doing this because he loved them. And he showed that God had this plan. This was all part of the plan, that even though I would, you know, you did me wrong, it was for a greater purpose, because now I could save the whole family. It is beautiful. It is touching. Oh, gosh, I love this story.
And this is actually a point where Hales, who, like we said, couldn't be with us, but he sent us some of his thoughts ahead of time. This is a point where he had an interesting comment. He said, it's worth recognizing that sometimes seemingly bad things happen to good people in order to open up the way for the accomplishment of God's purposes. But if we are true and faithful to the Lord, all things, whether in the moment they seem good or bad to us, can work together for your good, and with the help of Christ, who descended below all things, in order to know how to help us pass profitably through all things. So there really is this poignant message here about how God can take bad situations and suffering, even things that cause us pain and suffering and challenges and of all sorts, and God can, through those bad situations, he can accomplish great good. And we can even be his instruments to accomplishing great good through those challenging experiences, if we are willing to be, you know, true and faithful and stay the course despite the challenges and the suffering that we're dealing with.
And Joseph likely couldn't have accomplished this if he hadn't taken those steps to forgive and work through his pain of his brother's betrayal. But the power of forgiveness. Joseph was able to accomplish this because he could see beyond his own personal pain, and he could see God's greater purpose in that. And that's, again, a lesson for all of us about the importance of forgiveness and the importance of looking at the eternal perspective, even when things are really hard and even when things don't seem to make sense and when you feel you have been wronged. Being wronged and being part of God's plan are not mutually exclusive. I mean, bad things can happen in this life, and they can still be for a greater purpose. And it's really a message for the ages.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with that, we're essentially out of time. We only made it through half of our scripture block. Not even half of it, actually. But
you're listening.
There we go. Thank you for listening. This has been The Interpreter Show. I'm Neil Rapley. Jasmine is here with me. We hope you enjoyed it, and have a good night.
Bye.